And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. We're coming at you live on the Dark Matter Radio Network. We have a great show for you today. In a few minutes, we have our astronomy clip coming up with Andy Fleming, UFO news with the one, the only, John Tobin, and our guest for the show today is Kurt Collins. Kurt was on the past show with an interview with Colby Landrum. He basically interviewed Colby about the Cash Landrum case. But, you know, I wanted to get him back. He's an interesting guy, smart, and he's real balanced. So he's going to be on tonight. His website is blueblurrylines.blogspot.com. For those of you who have been emailing me, I do apologize. I'm in the middle of a project, and I'll get back to you when I can. I do have to say, though, some emails get to be that you might write me out there are like 4 or 5 pages long, and I got to tell you, I can't read those. I get all ADD'd out. My ADD has separation anxiety, and I can't read them. So if you want me to respond, just write maybe a single paragraph or two, and I will respond to you. So, hey, John, how you doing?
I'm excellent, Martin. How are you?
Do you get those long emails where you just can't read them?
I mean, I don't get any emails. I get emails, you know, spam. That's about it. You know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I know. I wake up every morning to a slew of spam that I just like delete, 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 delete every day. So,
yeah, if I can't cut it up and put it on a sandwich, I don't want any spam. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't like spam. So how's everything going?
Things are going well. You know, it's been a busy week, as you mentioned, but overall, very well. Can't complain.
Well, again, I'm glad to have you here with the news, and let's see. Let's take a listen to, we have Andy Fleming, and you know, it always comes up, and it's going to be part of our news, too. It always comes up that skeptics say that you just plain can't get here from there, and that's why we are not seeing any, you know, UFOs, and UFOs can't get here because it's physically impossible. So here's Andy Fleming right now for this week's astronomy bit.
You can't get from there to here is a recurrent claim often made by debunkers of the alien visitation hypothesis. But why not? There's nothing in the laws of physics to prevent it, although interstellar distances are truly vast. For example, the nearest star, the red dwarf Proxima Centauri, is at least 39.9 trillion kilometres away. Astronomers use light years to measure such vast distances. It's the distance light, travelling at 300,000 kilometres per second, travels in 1 year. At this speed, it would still take over 4 years to reach Proxima Centauri. To viably travel such distances in a human lifetime, we need to utilise propulsion systems that are theoretically possible, but beyond current technology. These would provide velocities close to that of light, or what scientists call relativistic speeds. There are certain problems, however. In a spacecraft travelling at such speed, the passage of time slows down relative to the observer in Earth's frame of reference. Hence, on a return journey to Proxima Centauri, virtually no time would have passed at all in the spacecraft's frame of reference, yet 8.5 years would have passed here on the Earth. This has nothing to do with watches, clocks, or the human aging process. It's counterintuitive, I know, and it's because the passage of time is relative, depending on your velocity relative to other points of reference. This is at the heart of Einstein's famous 1905 paper entitled On the Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies, his theory of special relativity. It is the speed of light that's the universal constant and not time, as Isaac Newton propounded. Another problem is that according to the paper's primary equation, E equals mc squared, as you travel towards the speed of light, ever increasing amounts of energy are required. To travel at the speed of light, a macroscopic object such as a spacecraft requires an infinite amount of energy, and will acquire an infinite amount of mass too. Light itself can travel at this speed precisely because its photon particles are massless. But here's a thought. Space-time itself can expand at velocities far greater than that of light. Cosmic inflation theory, widely accepted by cosmologists, states that in a fraction of a second after the Big Bang, our universe expanded to a gargantuan size at an unimaginable speed. This raises the possibility of interstellar travel via the use of Star Trek-like warp drives. Space-time would be shrunk in front of your craft and expanded rapidly at its rear. Admittedly, massive amounts of exotic matter and energy would be required. And then, of course, there are black holes. These are gravitational sinkholes in our universe, stellar remnants created by collapsed massive stars that have detonated as supernovae. Could the material entering a black hole exit in another area of our space-time in what is commonly called a wormhole? Theoretical work by physics has illustrated that these advanced propulsion systems for interstellar travel are indeed possible, and highlights the debunkers' claims as speculation at best. They mean that we can't get from here to there. For a paradigm-shifting breakthrough, we need new theories, and above all, imaginative scientists freed from the shackles of prevailing paradigms and conventional self-reinforcing prejudices. We may be just 4 centuries down the road of the scientific enterprise. However, in an immensely old and vast universe, I believe that there are many civilizations that are significantly further down that road. To believe otherwise is a regression to pre-Copernicanism and anthropocentrism. And who knows, some of those civilizations may be visiting the Earth right now.
I can buy that. That was pretty good, huh, John?
Absolutely, very good.
Yeah.
Definitely.
You know, I mean, you always hear that there's just no way. And later on in the news, I think we're going to kind of talk a little bit about one of the science magazines. I think it's Discovery Science or something like that. But let's just roll right in with the news.
Let's do that. Actually, yeah, the first story tonight actually has to do with the Big Bang, a smoking gun possibly found. Discovery News, as you mentioned, reports for the first time, scientists have found direct evidence of the expansion of the universe. It's a previously theoretical event that took place a fraction of a second after the Big Bang explosion nearly 14 billion years ago. The clue is encoded in the primordial cosmic microwave background radiation that continues to spread through space to this day. This has to do with the gravitational waves and all kinds of recent scientific theories. You can connect to this article, Martin, of course, as well as all of our other news stories and our show notes at podcastufo.com.
Yes, I read that article, and it gets really, really into it. You know, you just touched on, like, the light surface of it. But, you know, it seems like the more and more they look, the more and more they find, and it could be interesting. You know, I'm not 100% sold on the Big Bang, no matter how much evidence they have. It's just so hard to understand what was there before, or if it's a cycle that keeps happening. You know, maybe all the black holes swallow everything up and it goes down to nothing again. And this maybe this has happened like over and over again, but how did it ever start? You know, it's so, like, it's just too intense to think about all the whole thing.
it's very intense, and maybe it's the land where all the missing socks live. You know, I don't know.
That's what's happening. All right, what else is going on?
We've got some other interesting stories, too. Possibly a solar system out there littered with alien artifacts. That's another Discovery News article. There's some great stuff out there this week. Two Pioneer probes, a pair of Voyagers, and the New Horizon craft now speeding towards Pluto. If the aliens' motivations may be the same as ours, if we found an Earth-like world nearby, there would be an inevitable desire to send unmanned aircraft to see what kinds of creatures are living there. Looking for alien calling cards in the solar system is not a new idea by any stretch of the imagination. It's been popularized in numerous science fiction stories, movies, TV shows, etc., etc. So it's an interesting theory.
It is, but, you know, it just begs to ask the question, well, maybe we are being visited by probes. Maybe that's what some of the UFOs are. You know, but they'll never think that way. They just say, well, there's no evidence out there. So, but, you know, maybe some of the UFOs that we're seeing or all these people are seeing are probes that are exploring and observing us. I mean, they never even talk about that. I think that's rather curious.
They don't talk about it very often at all, and I agree with you. I think it's rather curious, and I think there's something to that for sure. Way too coincidental that, you know, thousands and thousands of UFO sightings, and none of them could possibly be visiting us. I think that's or other worlds for that matter, you know?
Yeah, yeah, they just don't want to hear about it. We're just all a bunch of kooks, you know? So what else is happening?
Well, you know, unfortunately, we do have some sad news this week.
Oh, yeah.
We want to say wish rest in peace to Dr. Roger Lear. Past guest Dr. Roger Lear passed away, unfortunately, on March 14th. He was a devoted ufologist, and he really brought the alleged alien implants to the forefront through surgically removing them and also running tests to explore what they were. So we just want to rest. We just want to wish, you know, rest in peace to Dr. Lear and all of his work. Very fondly thinking of him this week.
Yeah, and his family. And we have in our show notes his website, and there's a little place there if you wanted to make a donation in memory of him. It's right on his website there. And, you know, he was a real nice gentleman. I really enjoyed speaking to him. And he seemed like, you know, there was no games. I mean, he also talked about the Turkey UFO incident, which was a major UFO sighting seen by lots and lots of people. And a real nice guy, and he will sorely be missed.
Absolutely. And it's a shame when anyone passes, but when someone has done so much for this field, for ufology, it's just a really, it's a damp mode. And in the next story, you know, not that this next story is certainly not uplifting in any way, but it's certainly a mystery. It's one we talked about, you and I, last week a little bit, and now it's kind of come out in the UFO news here about the Malaysian Flight 370. Possibly an alien abduction. A lot of other theories have been talked about, and there's certainly tons of speculation that continues just this evening and every evening for that matter. But our guest here on the show, Martin, in a few weeks, the MUFON State Director, John Venture, or Ventry, how do you pronounce it?
Yes, Ventry.
Ventry, okay, great. He claims Malaysian Airline Flight 370, the crew and passengers were abducted by extraterrestrials. This story, his claim, made CNN, and you can also read the full story through the link in our show notes.
Yeah.
Now, what do you think about this?
Well, yeah, I'm not one who really enjoys confrontation, but I'm going to have to talk to him about this because I think it was rather a bizarre case to make. And also, you know, he sort of dragged MUFON's name into it, and he's in that new show, and I hear it's a good show, you know, by most people. But, you know, I'm not really sure what to think about it, but I do have to talk to him about it. You know, I like to be open-minded, but for that to happen, I think that's really going way overboard making a claim like that.
It's kind of an outrageous claim to come out without it, unless you had some solid proof to back it up. And at this point, it doesn't seem like there's solid proof of anything really showing exactly what might have happened. It's all speculation. And, you know, non-alien explanations are still speculation at this point. I will admit, though, that for myself, you know, I think a lot of us, the thought popped into our mind when several days went by and this thing was still missing. But I think the reality that kicks into our minds kicked in and said, you know, really not likely. But, you know, we thought of it, I think.
Yeah, of course, you know. But, you know, there's so many other answers that will, you know, it's probably, I think we'll probably know what happened eventually. It's just, you know, where it crashed. You know, it probably ditched in the ocean. It's a big ocean. And, you know, there's actually some talk about satellite images of possibly seeing some type of debris or something like that. So I think within, you know, within a few weeks we'll probably know. But it sure is a mystery that something like that happening. That's
absolutely
for sure.
We'll definitely be keeping our eyes on that as anything develops.
Yeah. So, hey, John, thanks for joining us today for the news.
And
hey, it's a pleasure to have you live on the news here.
So. It's a pleasure to be on. I enjoy
it. Yeah, you're a busy guy. Sorry. All right. So, hey, you got to sign up at the chat room. It is podcastufo.com if you're listening live. And you just jump right over to the right-hand sidebar, and it's a 1-2 click, and you're in. So we have our guest coming right up after this real quick music break. And Kurt Collins will be joining us. How you doing, Kurt?
Good.
Good. Welcome to the show. And I talked to you. I really wanted to have you on after last time. I thought you did a really thoughtful and great balanced job when you were interviewing Colby. So it's good to have you back.
Yeah, it was an unusual situation because we were both talking to Colby at that time, but not really to each other.
That's right. That's right. But since that time, we've gotten to know each other a little bit on the phone and through emails and stuff. And why don't you tell the listening audience out there, you know, what it's always an interesting path how someone gets involved in this subject, and what led you down the path of UFOs?
Well, I was interested from childhood, and I think just probably had a civilian's interest in UFOs and, you know, also some of the other neat stuff like Bigfoot and everything else, and drifted away from it. But in the past few years, I became more interested, and I started looking into some military cases. I thought those might provide some clues that might lead somewhere, either some documents or, you know, who knows if there's any film anywhere. And I came across the Cash Landrum case, and that had so many elements I'd already become familiar with. So that was a perfect match, and that's something I've really been able to sink my teeth into.
Yeah. Now, you live in somewhere in the South, right?
That's right, in Mississippi, in the Jackson area.
Uh-huh. Now, what is the activity in your general area like, and do you get involved in any of the research locally?
There are a fair number of sightings. There was one in an area that I just moved to last year that I don't consider myself a field investigator, but there was a report of a black triangle in the area. So and supposedly it was even appearing at a predictable time. So I chose a cold winter night to go out and look at it, and you know I stayed out there for an hour and a half. And if I try it again, it's going to be in spring weather with a breeze and you know an ice cooler. So field work wasn't for me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I hate to say it this way, but you really don't know what cold is. Here in Maine, let me tell you something. We've had a winter that just won't give out, you know. It's been something else. So, now, besides the Cash Landrum case, are there other cases you've been working on or interested in or similar ones?
Well, there are. Now, I've really almost put blinders on to this, but it is since it ran through the 80s, there's so many other things that have been involved. It touches the Paul Benowitz case. There were some other sightings, not nearly as well known in the 80s, right before and after that, and some even in the Texas area. There was a sighting in. I became interested in one called Carol Wayne Watts in Loco, Texas. That was in 1967, and that's regarded as a hoax, and it has men in black in it and everything else. But I found that one particularly fascinating. John Keel and Gray Barker both kind of covered that. And in fact, Kevin Randall, I think that was his first field investigation. He interviewed Carol Wayne Watts, and it's a pretty fantastic story because he saw this cylinder-shaped UFO And in his first encounter, he only heard a voice. I think it was maybe only a week or two later where they didn't abduct him, but they, I guess he felt intimidated to go on board, and he got examined, and these were little gray men, not quite the grays as we've come to know them, but and the stories become regarded as a hoax. But what's interesting is that his aliens, as described, are sort of an intermediate step between what the Hills saw and the grays as we've come to know them. And the fact that was a fabricated step is strange. You know, you just have to wonder if our ideas about aliens are not more in our heads or our understanding or our perception than however they really exist.
Yeah, sounds like the missing link to me. Hey, if you're listening live on the Dark Matter Radio Network, please jump over to podcastufo.com, over to the right-hand side, and jump in our chat room. And it's a 1-2 click, and you're in. So, Kurt, since you and I and Chris Lambright interviewed, well, mostly you and Chris Lambright interviewed Colby Landrum, there has been a couple of developments. Can we talk about any of that?
Well, the first one, there were a few people that got in touch, mostly that had useless information, I think, that wanted to attach themselves to the case. And I wonder if that hasn't happened all along with the – I think that's, you know, anything receives publicity. But to concentrate on the genuine developments, I was able to continue conversation with Colby Landrum. And it's been irregular. I think you know he's difficult to reach.
Mm-hmm.
But he was able to give me some better descriptions of the UFO. And you know, Chris Lambright that was on, he had done a painting of the witnesses based painting of the scene based primarily of the lady's description and not so much with Colby's input. And after giving him, I had him go through the drawings that had the original case drawings and have him pick out what he thought was the closest. And he identified a large featureless diamond. Didn't have the blue lights that have been, you know, been associated with it erroneously.
Right.
And, so then after he identified this big featureless diamond, I said, well, how about this painting by Chris Lambright? And he said that it gave him chills. He felt it was very close. The only thing he said, if he could add the helicopters into the scene, which, you know, they supposedly came in later, but he felt it was very close. So, and, you know, just when we were talking to him and then since, it's clear that his memory of events and even things afterward is not precise. He, for example, he told me about I think their first media exposure afterwards, they went to Good Morning America. They flew to New York, and I asked him about the show and what it was like, and he really didn't remember it, but he remembered the limousine ride.
Uh-huh.
And he remembered tugging on his ear to say hello to his mom during the show. So, you know, there's little bits and pieces here and there. And I think that's true of the experience itself.
Well, when you're seven, wasn't he 7 years old or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, actually a month short of his seventh birthday. Yeah. So, and usually when you see pictures of him, it's from a year or two later. I mean, it's very difficult to realize, you know, just, you know, he was just a step away from being a baby at the time it happened. I mean, you know, and his grandmother was very protective of him.
Now, there was I remember you writing me, and Peggy on the message board just mentioned this. You wrote me at one point that he was absolutely livid about, what is it, close encounters, the depiction of the case?
Well, that's true. And now, he didn't see one that was worse. Let me tell you about this first. I think Peggy had seen this program. It was called Unsealed Alien Files. And it was horrible. They had they saw a diamond-shaped object. Well, they depicted the UFO as a flying saucer, and it zaps Betty Cash with a ray beam. I mean, it was just so inaccurate as to be laughable if it wasn't a tragic situation. So, you know, so that was really terrible. But on this new show, Close Encounters, which debuted in Canada, is now just being shown in the United States. In their depiction of it, There were a number of errors. They get the county wrong. They say that they saw that UFO for an hour before they encountered it, you know, when it stopped the car, I mean. Mm-hmm. And worst of all, they depicted the UFO as shooting lightning bolts somehow. Yeah. And, you know, that was never in any description. I think one researcher who was trying to analyze the propulsion of the UFO speculated that it was some sort of plasma. But the lightning, that I can tell you how that happened. There were two researchers that they interviewed for the show, and they both made a couple of minor mistakes. Well, I guess the lightning I would consider a major mistake. And they didn't fact check. And, you know, these programs, this one's called Close Encounters, and really that's the only part of the show that they depict is the encounter itself. They don't follow up on the investigation or the lives of the people afterward. It's, you know, it's only a half-hour show, and they do 15 minutes per case, well, less with commercials. So, you know, they just get in there, they do a dramatic recreation, and yeah, but there were several points of inaccuracy. Now, I think the show, I mean, has good production values. They've chose some reasonable cases and stay away from the sensational alien abductions and things like that. But it could be better still.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, like you said, Colby is hard to, you know, keep in touch with. And I do remember when we were interviewing him, someone actually, I believe, it could have been on the message board or it could have been a call-in, I can't remember, but prompted him to do a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request on papers regarding this. Has anything like that happened at all?
I'd mentioned that to Colby, but he had, I think, I'm not sure if he had moved for a new job outside his home when we recorded our show, but I know he had when I talked to him last, and really haven't had contact since. So mm-hmm. I think he's been kind of busy with that, but I certainly have intended to. I thought that the chance of getting him to do a privacy waiver might yield better results, because sometimes the government's reluctant to release information on individuals. You know, they think it's going to be a violation of their privacy. So him signing that would relieve them of that worry.
You know, I thought it was interesting when he was on the show. You know, I don't want to just rehash the whole show in this show, but one of the things I thought was kind of interesting is what he thought the craft was, you know, most likely government or military. And, you know, that almost makes the most sense when you really look at all the options.
Yeah. It's a very tempting scenario. And what we're missing is evidence, but an evidence of anything else also. The good point that was made on the Close Encounter show is that there's been no classified vehicle that resembles that. It's really puzzling, though, because if it was a classified device, it would have to have a history of development, probably of several years. Usually there are prototypes or stages, you know, several prototypes before something's built. So it could be, but the secrecy required is extraordinary.
Well, you know, like Peggy just mentioned on the message board, she doesn't think that it was military, but she thinks the military was involved. And, you know, that's quite a scenario right there. And, you know, perhaps that makes kind of sense in a way.
Oh, well, that's that touches on something. I just recently gave a Skype talk to the MUFON Alabama group, and I got in touch with a member of the unit that's Task Force 160, the Night Stalkers, the helicopter group that grew out of the chief suspect for the helicopters in the Cash Lanham case. And there's a pilot there that he joined in 1984, but he's given me a lot of useful information on the operation of the helicopter unit, the helicopters themselves. And now he's also a UFO investigator, field investigator for MUFON. So, you know, I think he's sympathetic, and I don't believe he's being deceptive in any way. And one of the things that he said is he just doesn't believe, with the distance involved, that it could have been anything But, well, it couldn't be a response. There's no way that the helicopters had the fuel to get from a base to the scene. He thinks that for whatever reason, they had to be flying along with it. Yeah. So Peggy's onto something.
Yeah, and I believe you threw me an email about this this pilot. And we have a guest, Skinny Bob, is asking, are you familiar with the Black Deltas, which are supposed to be the huge black op military craft that are lighter than an aircraft like Zeppelins?
I've heard of that, but have no specific knowledge. The name, though, is interesting because Paul Benowitz had a drawing of what he called a Black Delta ship, and he thought it was atomic powered, and he made connections between that and the Cash Lanham case. But, you know, that's all speculation.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's interesting. But yeah, the lighter than air aspect is interesting because the UFO in this case did seem to be almost balloon-like or anti-gravity, and, you know, we don't know what the fire burst was, but that didn't seem to be what was propelling it. It might have been for something to stabilize it or a leak of some kind.
Now, about ufology in general, you're not really, pardon me, that much involved in it, and but you are mostly in this case. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
I've got a broader interest, but a specific focus, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about the broader interest. Are there other aspects of the field that you like to, you know, for instance, do you ever look into, well, let's say the abductions, or do you ever look into different types of crafts or things like that, or any other historic cases come to mind to you?
Well, yes. Due to my initial interest, which was back during the, the NICAP days, I do kind of favor the cases from the 60s back to the Kenneth Arnold sighting. And I've probably read more about those than I have more modern accounts. And so because of that, I'm less familiar with the abduction scenarios except for the Parker Hickson, which happened in Mississippi. So I always had a particular interest in that. And, of course, the Hill abductions. But that is probably my least familiar territory. And some of the early cases, like Leveland, Texas, some of these involved objects which were remotely similar to the Cash Lanham case, a large egg-shaped, it was either brilliant or flaming. And in those cases, and there was also one in Loch Raven, and I forget what state that's in, that they affected automobile engines, and the people felt heat and thought they had a sunburn-like symptoms. So, you know, you have to wonder, you know, with the visual similarity and the similarity of symptoms, if those couldn't be related. And, I mean, and, you know, there's, of course, like the frustrating thing in all UFOs cases is coming up with adequate proof. I mean, there's a definite experience. You've got credible witnesses. But, you know, when you find proof or evidence left behind, you can't always piece it together. So,
right. Yeah. Well, you know, you think of, like, you just mentioned egg shape, like the Socorro incident. Is that one of the ones so there was a big flame that came out of that thing and heat
and
everything.
Yeah, but not the object itself. And that's an interesting one, too, because, for example, the ones in Texas I just mentioned, those did not have a fire-like shape. But Socorro was a definite structure. You know, it had legs and apparently a hatch, and there was a symbol on it. There's no mistaking that for a natural object. I mean, there's no confusion between those two. That's one case that's fascinating because it's, it's clearly an intelligently designed and manned craft. That's our friend Chris Lambright, that's a favorite of his, and he interviewed Officer Zamora. And that was, I think, a turning point in Dr. Hynek's opinion about UFOs. that they couldn't all be mistakes of astronomical features, and you know the traces left behind. You know, some of them were ambiguous, but you know, you had a highly credible witness there.
Right, right, and you know, you talk about evidence, and I speak with Ray Stanford, who eventually I'm going to meet and spend some time at his house down in Baltimore, and he was like right there about he was there the same time Hynek was there, and you know, I think I might have mentioned this in a past podcast, but if you read his book, I forget what it's called, The Flying Saucer, Socorro, whatever it is. He actually picked up a rock that had metal scrapings on it. You know, he actually had the closest thing to evidence because it was right where the pad landed of one of the three legs that came down on that thing. He had that actually in his hands at one time and lost it through when he was getting it tested. So they scraped it all off and it was gone.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you, you know, that's a show I would love to hear. He has spanned the ages. I mean, I think a lot of times people forget about his contribution to the field just because of, he's not so involved in current research. It's kind of isolated himself and chooses only to discuss things with a number of people. But he must have some great stories.
Yes, he's a brilliant man. He actually researches dinosaurs for a living.
I've seen his name in the news about that. He's discovered a number of fossils and tracks.
He found tracks right on the Beltway in Baltimore, which is amazing. Hey, someone was asking on the chat room, what is your opinion on disclosure? Have you thought about it?
I have. Okay. I have, and I'm conflicted. To be honest. I've read Dr. Alexander's book, John Alexander, and I tend to agree with some of the things he said. Was that the government may not actually know very much, and maybe their interest is focused on security. You know, Donald Kehoe, who introduced a lot of the world to UFOs, it was his belief that the government did know what was going on. They were hiding it from us. But I'm not convinced that they are part of a secret alliance with aliens, or you know, those things are interesting, but I don't think they're very good at keeping secrets. It's possible, and I'd like to know more about, there's certainly things that they haven't told us because it relates to military secrets, or they think it does. You know, they're very choosy about what's shared with us, very protective of their operational policies and things, and there's a lot of controversy over what they're learning about us. But yeah, I would like to know more, but I just don't think that they have the answers. And I really think it's up to us, our researchers, and to do the work. I mean, just look typically at how the government conducts research. They outsource it. Even Dr. Hynek was contracted as an astronomer for the Air Force. So, you know, they may buy the answer from someone, but I don't think they have it themselves.
A lot of times, I think that you know some part of the government might know that UFOs exist, but maybe they're on the same page as us, that they don't know what they are, you know?
Right.
I because they're certainly still taking reports, you know, very quietly and involved in that, you know, even though they say they're not. Even in NORAD, you know, I mean, you hear all these things where these papers, I think John Greenwald has uncovered some, you know, documents that they're still, yes, it was him, and that they're still taking reports very quietly or documenting them.
Well, they have to. There's always going to be an element of a threat from whether it's a missile or an enemy plane. But, you know, I certainly want to know if an alien or a time traveler or whatever it could be is peeping in on us, or, you know, could be a threat. But, It's it's unfortunate that Blue Book went the way that it did. I mean, it was, some people say it was nothing more than public relations. I don't know that that's true, but I wish that there was some agency that even if it was just to channel it into the private sector and help coordinate with the groups.
Sure. I agree with that. And, you take a look at all the countries that take it seriously. And unfortunately, it's hard to do this show at 8 o'clock in Eastern time, New York time, when we have people like, for instance, I would like to get Klaus Svahn back on in Sweden because, that's another country that takes things seriously. There's no ridicule or very little ridicule about it. And Brazil and, France, all these countries have a little section that is paying attention to this and, want to know more about it. And Jose Lay, I really enjoyed speaking with him a number of times at a conference and actually, interviewing him. And how serious Brazil takes this whole thing. And it doesn't have to be, tomfoolery. It could be studied scientifically and looked at because it's something's going on. And you would think that when these countries do take it seriously, that it would eventually rub off and someone would start talking about it here in this country, in the government.
Oh, that reminded me of a couple of things. One is I saw that Leslie Kane is touring in France promoting her book, and apparently it's been very well received there. So they're mm-hmm. They're taking things seriously. And the other thing that reminded me of is one of the tools that I've used quite heavily in the research that I've done has been the internet. And I've heard Kevin Randall mention that that was something that he wishes he could, I guess, kind of move it back in time so that he'd had some of those resources available. And so often you can pull a document and from my own research, I can tell you absolutely cannot find everything you want. But the things that you can find quickly and then identify what are the documents you need, that is such a huge savings of time. And besides that, you're able to contact other researchers to share information. And when you were talking about international interests, I've got email pen pals around the world, and some are skeptics, some are believers. And it's just to be able to instantly communicate with them, well, sometimes with the help of a translator, but still, that's just an amazing resource. And there's I've got a Russian friend, and several times he has an immense UFO library, and I've had him scan documents. It's strange to think that, to find out an old APRO or MUFON report that I have to go to Russia to get it, but sometimes that's the fastest way.
Well, how about that? Yes, I have some connections in Russia, and they're sort of for the most part, Russia's extremely large, a huge country, but they take it more or less serious for the most part. And I don't know if you heard about this about the Ukraine. Did you happen to see the video of the big cylinder shaped UFO that went over the Ukraine right near I can't remember how you say it, Crimea.
No,
you know what I mean.
No, I haven't seen that. How recent is that?
Oh, that was a few weeks ago that happened, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I'd have to tell you, I'm slightly allergic to YouTube videos. I have to wait until I get a personal recommendation.
Yeah, I
understand
that. There's
so many.
Yeah, there's it's YouTube is unfortunately it's a double edged sword. There's what happens is all the trash that muddies the water of the legitimate ones. It's too bad because there are a lot of good videos on there, but there's also a lot of people either trying to make a name for themselves or having fun with CGI it's a shame. And then I'm just going to plain say this: third phase of the moon. You want to stay away from all the listeners. I'm just telling you there's a lot of bogus videos that they put on that. And, he can sue me if he wants, But I think he's just a big BSer, and it's a big problem.
Well, I've checked that out. I agree with you. If he's suing you, I guess I'll sit next to you at the table in court. I totally agree with that. The one thing I will say about them is that a couple of times they've had people like Stanton Friedman appear on their show or do a video of them, and that is my only exception. I will sometimes check. I don't know how a legitimate person ever winds up getting connected with them, but it has happened a few times. And I listened to the if you do watch a video, even with a reputable person, just don't look at the screen because there's going to be some baloney pictures up. Just listen to the speaker.
Yeah. What are the, you know, along these lines, why do you think people do hoax? You know, what is it that, what is it, kind of like the same type of people that write viruses for computers, do you think?
Oh, well, that's kind of a malicious thing. But, well, you know, I've actually thought about hoaxers quite a bit. In fact, I had a friend who had committed a few hoaxes when he was young and irresponsible. That was Jim Moseley. I've examined. Yeah, I'm not done a formal study of this, but I think there's a few types, and the ones that you compared to viruses, I think some of them are kind of like pyromaniacs. They enjoy starting trouble and seeing what happens, you know. But I think they're also egotistical and they want to claim credit for it. In hoaxing, you know, some other people are, you know, do want to draw attention to themselves. I mean, but hoaxing is by no means unique to the UFO field. In fact, I think the paranormal field, the hoaxing there began way back. I mean, you know, probably before the 1900s.
You know, it probably from the beginning of time. You know, really, there's the people selling medicines on the stumps and the soap boxes, and you know, there's always some type of hoaxing going on.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that fraud and monetary gain, that's one thing. But you know, some other people are, they're trying to make a buck off it, and you could go through the history of ufology and pick out some of those. One of them is the famous Aztec crash, Silas Newton and Dr. G, and they were promoting this the UFO crash as a way to sell these fake instruments to detect oil. They claim to have used the magnetic devices from the recovered UFO technology to make oil detectors, basically. So, you know, there are fakes like that are cashing in. There was one guy, I think it was Buck Nelson, and he claimed to have gone to outer space, and he had he claimed his dog was from outer space, had gone with him. Anyway, he sold clippings of his dog's hair as souvenirs. And, wow. You know, just some off-the-wall things like that.
Along these lines, I'd like to say something, since I already trashed third phase of the moon. you know, it seems to me that sometimes I can get a little bit discouraged in this field, and it seems to me that the crazier and more outrageous someone becomes in this field, the more followers they have. What's your take on that?
Well, you have a good point. For one thing, well, one of my favorite UFO sightings, just to provide contrast, was Charles B. Moore, 1949, April. He's launching weather balloons with a team of men. They see a sphere. No, it wasn't really spherical. It was kind of like a flat oval thing flying across, and they're looking at, I forget what the name of the device is, but basically it's a telescope to observe things like weather balloons and such. So, I mean, you have a scientific instrument that he's watching this through, and it goes across the sky at a huge rate of speed and then goes upwards. Well, the thing is, this I can't remember, but, you know, we're talking about maybe a minute or so. Well, it's an incredible sighting. It's something unearthly, but, you know, it's over and done. And it's not interesting as a story. And then you get something like a George Adamski, and he meets this spaceman and communicates with him telepathically. And it's this long, involved story, and usually the guy's right there at the center of it. And a lot of times he continues to have a series of adventures. And it's a good story. That's the difference.
Right, right. You know, but you there are people in this field. You know, there's someone right now going through some court trouble. He's in big trouble, and you know he's got a lot of support, and he's blaming things, of course, on the government, and his wife is right, you know, at his back with it. And then, you know, they just have a huge amount of followers, and the people out there that are doing the serious work, there are people like Stan you talked about earlier. You know, someone like him, I think, deserves a lot of people listening to him and, you know, paying attention to him. But these people that come up, like you just mentioned, Adamski, you know, I mean, people like that, they had all the, it's kind of like a cult, you know, it's the only other way I can think of it. And, you know, we pick on Dr. Stephen Greer, you know, and a lot of people give me hate mail after I do that. But, you know, he's a very intelligent man. He's well-spoken. But he can go down those paths that, you know, are just outrageous, you know, Ambassador of the Universe and bringing in, you know, summoning in craft and all that. It's pretty outrageous.
Well, I don't want to drag myself into this example I'm about to bring up, but the things that a lot of times the charlatans are the ones that are demonstrating the personality and charisma and everything. So, you know, and Dr. Hynek had a beard and a pipe, but, you know, he wasn't really a fireball in the personality department. So maybe just as your little yardstick, look at, you know, the dull guys are probably doing the real research.
That's right. You know, that it's sad to say, but you're probably right. You're probably right. And it's the same thing with, you know, true scientists. A lot of true scientists aren't some of you, you know, I mean, that are really intense and they're so involved in what they're doing, they don't, you know, really focus too much on the social parts. We have about 4 minutes left to this show, and I'm just looking to see if we have any. Someone was asking a little bit earlier on, Lee was asking, was there a point where you were skeptical about the UFO field to begin with, and what, if so, what made you turn into, you know, taking it more seriously?
Well, I'm still skeptical. I want proof, and there are a lot of things that I guess I just kind of have to keep an open mind about. But you know, I believe in the possibilities, and I don't take everyone's word for anything. I try to have to, I just hate to say that I rely on the way things sound and feel, but a lot of times it is a gut reaction. And, yeah, but I like the things that can actually be investigated. I prefer not to deal with stories where someone's gone and they've seen something. I mean, it's almost, I get excited about this. The ones that are the most frustrating, they could almost be spiritual visions because there's nothing to investigate.
Exactly. Let's see. Peggy wanted to know, are there any current cases that, you know, we only have a couple minutes left, but are there any current cases that are ongoing right now that interest you? You can say no.
I'm interested, but not following closely. The black triangles continue to fascinate me, but I haven't found anything that I could sink my teeth into there.
Right. Yes, that is one that fascinates me too. And there's I forget the gentleman's name that has written a book on the black triangles. That one is interesting, you know, getting me fascinated because you hear of so many similar cases, and I would love to find out more about that. So, Kurt, where can someone find you on the internet?
I've got a site called blueblurrylines.com, and I've got, now that's going to be 90% information on the Cash Landrum case, but the thing that I feel that's important about this is that there, I'm looking into not just the case itself, but the way that it was investigated, and I think that there's also the issue of military secrecy. So whatever's going on here, I think this is why I focused on it, is that it applies to a lot of other UFO cases. So I think that, you know, getting to the bottom of this, or at least understanding it a little better, you know, it can be applied to many other things.
Uh-huh. You know, Peggy just said there were a couple of about 20 reports of Boomerang and Triangle sites just today on MUFON. So, yeah, they seem to be the going vehicle of the choice craft of whatever's visiting us.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I just wonder if it's a trend. You know, if it's almost like if you hear a new word and learn it, all of a sudden you hear it everywhere. Are we being kind of conditioned to notice that? Is it were we just looking for the wrong thing when we were only looking for saucers or cylinders? But there are people have gone back and looked and have found some older triangle sightings, but yeah. You know, it definitely, you know, is much more prevalent today than it was long ago.
All right. Well, Peggy was yelling at me that it was not the last 20, it was the last 20 reports. Well, that's it for tonight. Thank you, Kurt. And that's it for our show. So if you missed any part of the show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on our website, which is podcastufo.com. Also, you can check out our links and stories and our show notes, as well as joining in the conversation in our forums. I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Keith Rowland, the producer of the Dark Matter Radio Network, Andy Fleming for the Astronomy News, John Tobin for the UFO News, Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for our music, and Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. And remember to like us on Facebook. I think we have about 8,000 people on there now. And Peggy keeps up with all the UFO news, so check that out at facebook.com/podcastufo. You can just check us out live next week right here on the Dark Matter Radio Network and every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And don't forget to jump in the chat room at podcastufo.com. This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky.